Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and right now, this minute, in front of a nondescript building just east of Washington Square Park in the Village, a group of several hundred is gathered to commemorate the 100-year anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. On March 25, 1911, a major fire broke out on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the factory building. It was a Saturday afternoon. At the Triangle factory, the mostly immigrant women, many of them Jews working the Sabbath, and Italians between the ages of 16 and 23, worked 6 days a week, upwards of 9 hours on weekdays, 7 on Saturday. Managers had locked most of the doors and stairwells of the building, and when the fire ripped through, many workers jumped from windows in a desperate attempt to escape. Ultimately, 146 people died, the largest industrial accident in New York City history. The tragedy spurred a push toward unionization and improved working conditions all over industrial America. In the first half of the century, workers' collectives fought for basics, 8-hour days, 5-day weeks, collective bargaining, and safer conditions. A shirtwaist, by the way, is a separate women's blouse constructed like a shirt. We don't use that word anymore. 100 years after the fire, we are once again watching pitched battles over unionization around the country. Joshua Freeman, history professor at Queens College and the Graduate Center at CUNY, is with us now. He wrote about the legacy of the Triangle Fire for The Nation this week. We will also meet some folks with personal and family connections to the fire. For now, Professor Freeman, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Glad to be here. And if you don't mind me correcting something, I just left the site of the ceremony.
And yes, and thank you for... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but there are thousands of people. It's
really?
Quite a scene going on out there.
Describe
it.
Tell us more about what it's like down there.
Well, they have Washington Place blocked off, which is in front of the building, and there's a speaker's podium. And then when I left, there are three blocks full of people. They're union people, lots of banners. There are shirt waists that they are carrying on poles with the name of each victim across it. It's kind of eerie, these white blouses with victims' names. Many are being held by descendants of the people who died. There are school children out there. There are hard hats out there and lots of fire department presence, a big fire truck parked in front of the building where the fire took place. So it's quite a scene.
Current union battles, like those taking place in Wisconsin, are about pensions and benefits that many people consider too poofy. On the other hand, I saw in the Times today that the House of Representatives has a bill to deny food stamps to workers on strike, and that appears to cover the private sector as well. So is there any connection to the battles over basic working conditions and hours in the first half of the last century and what we're seeing in Wisconsin, say, today?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's lots of ties because, you know, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire came amidst a huge effort to unionize the industry. That particular factory had been struck just 2 years earlier, a fierce 13-week strike in which most of the industry agreed to recognize the union. That factory refused. So when the fire occurred, it was already a very well-known company for its anti-unionism. And you know, the issue in Wisconsin is not just benefits, but it's the basic right, in that case, of public sector workers to organize. In Indiana, so-called right-to-work legislation is at play. In Maine, the governor wants to rename two conference rooms named after two people intimately connected with the Triangle events, Rose Schneiderman and Francis Perkins. He wants to eliminate the names of those conference rooms in the Department of Labor up in Maine because he thinks they're not neutral. So,
and you know, he wants to obliterate a mural depicting workers through history on the State Labor Department building. I don't know if you heard about that.
Yes,
in Maine.
I did. And inside that building are these conference rooms. Rose Schneiderman was a garment worker, and in a huge memorial meeting at the Metropolitan Opera after the fire, gave a famous speech, you know, kind of taking the public to task for its indifference until this death had occurred.
We should put a picture of that mural on our site next week and ask people if they think it takes sides in labor disputes or just depicts history. But let us meet, as we recall the Triangle Fire, Lillian Swanson, managing editor of The Forward, the Jewish American newspaper. They published a special issue this week, which includes first ever translations of some of the articles published around the time of the Triangle Fire, when The Forward was a Yiddish-only paper. Lillian, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
From reading the original reporting, how much was the fire something that struck the Jewish community in Manhattan?
Oh, I think it was a huge event. Ab Kahan, the editor of The Forward's, said it so well in one of his editorials. He said the entire neighborhood is sitting Shiva, and that meant the Lower East Side, because so many people had been affected and so many families had been torn apart by grief.
Do you have a favorite letter or article you'd be willing to read from that archive?
Sure. I have, in our special section, we translated some of the pieces that were written right after the fire. They're very raw, they're very emotional, evocative. I'd be happy to read one now if you'd like.
Please.
Okay, this is March 29, 1911. This is from the pages of The Forward's. A muted violin is all that remains of them. A fiddle hangs on the wall, but the hand that played it is lying somewhere, a piece of coal. Among the 30 bodies in the morgue, it has not been found. On Saturday evening, Esther Rosen, a girl of 14, sat with her two little brothers, Sam, 10, and Abe, 8, in their threadbare house and waited for their mother and brother to come home. The mother, Mrs. Julia Rosen, 35, and her oldest son, Isaac, were working together in the Triangle shop. The mother and son used to go to work together and come home together and fill the dark rooms with light and joy. And the story goes on to talk about how they waited, and finally 14-year-old Esther had to go to the morgue where she identified her mother. But unfortunately, the brother, Isaac, they could not find him for quite a while. And then it ends by saying, not a sign could be found of the spirited boy who used to entertain everyone in the evening with his fiddle. These stories sort of take you right back to that time, those first few days after the fire. Wow. And the victims.
That one sure did. Lillian Swanson, managing editor of The Forward, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And labor historian Josh Friedman, we'll get back to you shortly. But right now let's bring in Tom Lansner, who is an adjunct professor at Columbia. Tom, you had known your whole life that your great aunt, Fanny Lansner, died in the fire, but I gather it wasn't until the last year or two that you got the full story. What did you think, and then what did you learn?
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on. I'm
sure.
Down at Washington Square watching a little bit of the ceremonies. Yes, I knew from when I was a kid that my great aunt had died in the fire, but the story that came out in 2003, there was a book that came out by David Mondrilli that described her as caught on the 10th floor and not being able to go one way or the other as some of her friends escaped. And this was taken from court testimony. It was a description that was available. And just in the past year, in the run-up to the 100th anniversary, there's been more research done, and particularly one researcher, Michael Hirsch, found a New York Evening Telegram story from the day after the fire that described my great aunt Fanny as a heroic young forewoman who saved lots of the girls working under her, her crew, by keeping them near the elevators, keeping them calm, speaking to them in Yiddish and English, it described her, and until they could escape. But unfortunately, she missed the last elevator down and jumped from the 9th floor and died.
To what extent has your thinking about the women at the shirtwaist factory as pure victims changed as a result of learning this story?
Well, of course, for myself, to learn that she wasn't just a pathetic victim who died because of her own indecision was really a revelation and has great meaning to me. But it has to be seen in the context of the union movement and the social movement of the times. These women died as victims not just of that fire, but of the system around them. But a lot of the women, I think as you've heard, were people who joined the union protests, who fought for a living wage, who fought in the social justice movement of the time. So I always knew these women were not just victims of this fire, but were people who were actively trying to improve their whole lives. And I think in the new narrative, or the rediscovered narrative of my own aunt, I take real inspiration that not only did she have some real courage in her final moments, but was part of a larger movement of the time to better their conditions and to have better lives.
Tom Lanzner, adjunct professor at Columbia, thank you so much for that. By the way, listeners, we have a link to that special edition of The Forward out now on our site. So if you want to go to WNYC.org, you can get to that, which Lillian Swanson was talking about before. And Josh Freeman, as you listen to these stories of how this incident was originally reported, how quickly did outrage over the fire transform into political activity? And is that typical, that major incidents tend to spark periods of reform?
Well, in this case, it very quickly turned into massive protest. And I think it was because there were already groups concerned with these issues, not only the union and the workers themselves, but progressive reformers were aware of this. And so very quickly, you got an outpouring of grief in the funerals, an outpouring of protest. And out of that came a decision by the New York Democratic Party, Tammany, to actually embrace factory reform. So they set up a reform commission, and it recommended a bunch of changes which took place. So this is an example where you did get change out of tragedy. But, you know, there were four mine accidents in that same 10-year period, each of which killed more people than Triangle, that led to no reform. So there's no immediate or necessary correlation. We're seeing Triangle fires all over the world, you know, 20 people, 30 people in Bangladesh, in other places where our clothes are made today, and unfortunately, they don't necessarily spark big changes.
Lastly, we are joined by Emily Danies, a lawyer in Tucson, Arizona. She contributed a story to the Triangle Fire Open Archive Project called The Picnic That Saved My Grandmother's Life. And then we will get back to Josh again. Emily, thank you so much for joining us. Hello from New York.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Oh, great. Oh, wonderful. My grandmother, Anna Pilevsky Shomsky, worked at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory with her cousin, and the day of the fire, she boarded a streetcar to go to work and recognized several men and women, young men and women, from her hometown of Cobrin, where she was her family had been very educated and wealthy. She was the great-great-granddaughter of the Cobriner Rebbe, and she wasn't allowed to socialize with most of the young people. But when she came to America, she completely rebelled. She sees these people on a streetcar as she's on her way to work at the Triangle Factory, and they told her they were going on a picnic, and would she join them? And impulsively, she did. She did not go to work. She ended up going to the picnic and meeting a young man there from her town, Cobrin, Philip Shomsky, who she ultimately married.
Mm.
So I'm here because she went on that picnic. The other part of the story that's interesting is her cousin, who we only knew as Tanta Polly, was trapped in the fire and jumped out of the window, as did many other young women, expecting to die. But her skirt caught on a metal hook that protruded from the building, leaving her hanging in the air where the firemen did rescue her. And that story was verified in a 1958 interview with a Triangle Fire survivor that's on the Cornell website of the Triangle Fire. Ultimately, my grandfather became a union organizer for the Milliners Union, and he and my grandmother were ardent socialists, and I believe as a result of this fire. So that's
really
my
fascinating.
Wonderful story.
That is an amazing story. Did she suffer survivor's guilt?
I don't know that she did. If she did, when I knew her, she was a very successful businesswoman and very bright, very compassionate and artistic. I didn't know her as someone who had survivor's guilt. I know that her cousin must have had some psychological trauma, and I've been thinking about that, how these people must have had incredible trauma after, and, of course, no psychiatric or psychological help. So,
indeed. Well,
I really don't know about... My grandmother seemed, you know, she was a wonderful person, and I don't know that how this affected her, really.
Emily Danies, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And we want to thank the Triangle Fire Open Archive and Gabrielle from the Folklore Project, Puscata. They have been collecting amazing stories about the Triangle Fire, including those of Tom and Emily that we heard. We've got a link on our website where you can read lots more and explore the archive at WNYC.org. We also have, again, that link to the special edition of The Forward out now that looks back. And to finish up with labor historian Josh Freeman, who's down at the ceremony in Lower Manhattan, remembering this 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. You said it's thousands of people when maybe they weren't expecting that many. Do you think that the turnout is larger than it might otherwise have been because of the new conflicts over unions going on in the country right now?
Maybe. You know, I think on some level the issue of the era of Triangle, you know, of great inequality, of not just wealth but power, of a feeling of kind of helplessness and wanting to do something about that, and then these incipient movements to address it. Maybe that resonates with some people today. You know, I think there's been a pretty amazing scene going on in Madison in the Midwest of not just unionists but other people mobilizing. So I think there may be something to that because it seemed to me out there it was pretty broad crowd. There were people, just in relation to the last story we heard, wearing buttons with pictures of what clearly, you know, relatives who had been at the fire, you know. Very moving, but then there are school kids and lots of union banners. So I think this is touching a lot of different nerves right now, and it's really quite an unusual event.
Do you think there are worker struggles? And you mentioned Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fires, in effect, going on in Bangladesh and all over the world today. Anything here on the U.S. on those same fundamental issues, true exploitation on the level of locking the fire exits at the Shirtwaist Factory?
Well, we've had unbelievable cases. I mean, they're unusual, but remember that El Monte case where you had they were garment workers who were literally slaves in a suburb of Los Angeles. You know, they're immigrant workers, undocumented. I think particularly among the immigrants, and of course the Triangle workers were immigrants in their day, among immigrant workforces is a lot of that kind of extreme exploitation, taking away passports and papers, demanding that people repay loans. There's a kind of underground illegal world there that is, in a way, the modern equivalent of the sweatshop.
And listen to this. Molly on our comments page, I took a women's history class while I was an undergrad at NYU. One day of the class was dedicated to the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. After the professor was done telling us the story, she explained that the fire had happened in the very building we were sitting in. It was a very moving lesson. And that's where you are right now. So labor historian Tom Lanzner, thank you for stepping away from the Josh Freeman, thank you for stepping away from the ceremony for a few minutes to help us remember the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire 100 years ago today.
Thanks.
Some music recorded just a little while ago from the ceremony itself. Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, and Paige Cowett produced this program with Alana Casanova-Burgess. We had intern help on different days this week from Kali Elaney, Annette Montalvo, Drea Bernardi, Abby Fleischer, Chris Remington, and Michael McCutcheon. It's a freecountry.org editor, Caitlin Thompson, and our senior producer is Megan Ryan. That's Debbie Fountain and Leora Noam Kravitz at the audio controls today. Talk to you Monday. Have a great weekend. I'm Brian Lehrer.